It's always funny when you come back.
It's just
as many times as we do this, there's always this fear that when we do a talk on Friday night that nobody will come back Saturday morning, you know? And it's just, you're here. I was so relieved. I was getting some juju off that. That's good. What we're going to do is, first off, I got to tell you that I'm going to go back to the States and we're going to start Swedish Coffee Anonymous. I sitting there during that meditation wondering why my butt was vibrating on that seat. I was like, I'm addicted. I just can't. My gosh. Before we get started today, I wanted to especially take a minute to thank some friends that I've met, new friends that I've met here from DAA. And Drug Addicts Anonymous is real new in the States. We're very few folks there doing it now. Primary Purpose Group, the group that I go to in Dallas, on a Tuesday night, we'll have 200 people in that room all studying the Big Book. But these guys, it's an AA group. And these guys stay totally frustrated because they can't seem to find any place to get plugged in to study the Big Book as little dope fiends. And so, quite by accident, they stumble across a website from DAA here in Sweden and from Stockholm, and these guys started this group. And you ought to walk into that room on the nights when they're having this meeting. It's the biggest bunch of lathered up little dope fiends you've ever seen in your whole life. And they are having more fun than it ought to be against the law to have that much fun in a meeting. And it just, I am truly grateful because finally in the States, there's a place where people can go and study the Big Book and still fight this addiction around the drug. It's just, thank you so much for doing what you did on that. Here's what we want to try to do this morning. We don't have a lot of time, and so we're not going to try to go through a tedious thing through the steps. What we thought we might do is approach the steps from a slightly different perspective. We're going to look at the steps through the eyes of a sponsor who is interested in getting you through the steps quicker than you may have worked them yourself. Or quicker than you may feel comfortable getting somebody through the work. When I originally started studying the book 14 years ago after I got to Primary Purpose Group, one of the things that I realized real quick, one of the things that first stuck out was that there seems to be some urgency in the way the literature writes about the steps. Next, we launched out on a course of vigorous action. You remember these lines? There seems to be this kind of momentum that builds. You've made this decision to do this thing, and then there doesn't seem to be any place in the book where it says, well, now we sit on our butt for 5 months while we work on an inventory. It didn't say that. And so what we found was that if we kept a fire lit under this, if we just kind of turned the heat up a little bit, that these guys would work the work quicker and stay. And my view in doing this thing is seen from two perspectives. One, as my first 7 years in AA was, which is a meeting makers make it kind of guy, where you just come to the meeting and the steps you can deal with whenever you want to deal with them. That was my perspective for a lot of years. And that's how I felt so bad. That's why I got so sick. I can also look at it from the perspective of 15 years of working with hundreds and hundreds of men, getting them through the work in a timely fashion, and watching with a great deal of personal satisfaction how many of those men and women stayed. How many people came, got excited about recovery, and then stayed here to help carry the message. And so that's kind of how we'll couch this. We'll kind of approach it in that direction. There's always people that want to take exception to it. And if you want to take 2 years to work your guys through the work, fine. I'm not here, scout's honor. I'm not here to argue with you. I'm not here to debate you. I won't spend 2 seconds trying to debate that issue. I won't. If it works for you and you're comfortable with it, fine. Fine. We're just trying to point, just give you another viewpoint, just something you might consider, and then you can judge for yourself whether or not you want to fool with it or not. Of interest, I want to read you a couple of things real quick, and this is only going to take about 10 minutes to do, and then Chris is going to start us into the deal. But this is the foundation that we're talking about. Chris talked about a common solution last night, it's on page 17 in our books. I'll give you the page numbers. I was delinquent. I didn't find out whether or not our page numbers sync with your page numbers in your Swedish book. Sometimes they do and sometimes they don't. But I'll give you the page numbers anyway in our book, in the American version of this, and then you can sort it out later. At the bottom of page 17, there's a paragraph that we've all read before. It says, "The feeling of having shared in a common peril is one element in the powerful cement which binds us." Period. Now, what they're telling us is that there's nobody here that doesn't remember how cool it was to walk into an AA meeting, right? We do. We know how cool it was to be in a room full of like-minded people. But that in itself would never have held us together as we are now joined. I knew there was going to be a catch. The tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution. Period. See, what Bill Wilson and Bob and those guys did when the first 100, when they wrote this, what they figured was that they would write this book, which would give us a set of directions, which would keep all of us in a common solution. We would be trying to do this. My experience working the steps and her experience working the steps may be two completely different things. How we reacted to the steps may be different. These are our individual experiences that are important. But how we got from point A, busted up little drunk, to recovered alcoholic over here should be a lot more similar than they are worldwide. We have guys telling us over here to take a step a year or a step a month or a step. There's all these opinions about how we're supposed to do this stuff. And yet the literature gave us a pretty clear-cut picture of what the steps were supposed to be like. And we've chosen to walk away from a lot of that in a lot of our meetings. We do this. And so, keeping that in mind, turn over to page 24. I'll read it. You don't have to do it if you don't want to do that. You guys have read this 100 times, but I'm going to read this again. "The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink." Bill Wilson and Bob and those cats were trying to tell us going in, you're not going to have but just a little piece of time there in order to get this stuff started. You better be on a spiritual path fairly quickly, or you won't remember. How many times have you guys done this where you walked into a treatment center and there was a guy in there who was so beat up? This little fried pie guy. He's just burnt to a crisp. And he's sitting there and you start talking to him a little bit and he's compliant. He wants to do anything you want to do. He's, "I'm ready to do this." Terrific. But because the treatment center sets it up so we can't do any step work while they're in treatment, we have to wait until they're almost out of treatment. So now we got this guy that's ready and willing to do anything. He'd eat a handful of spiders if you gave them to him. He'd do anything. So 27 days later, we walk back to the treatment center and we walk in and we're looking for Sam. Where is Sam? We're going to do some step work today. We're going to start his deal. And you're looking around and he's, "Sam?" And there's this little arrogant pissant sitting back against the back wall. He's got his arms folded like this. "You ready to go, buddy? You ready to do the work?" "What for?" "I'm okay." See, Sam has had 27 days of good food, some exercise. He's had the blowtorch back off his rear end for 27 days. He's bulletproof. That's what the book is talking about. He's past the window. He's done. Now the arrogance and the ego has begun to rekindle itself. And here is a little guy that's not nearly as compliant as he was. He didn't care. We call it the AA Trinity, the job, the girl, and the car. That's all he cares about. That's it. All he wants to know is, can I get my job back so I can get a car? If I can get a car, I can get the girl. And if I can get the girl, well, I'm okay. I could always stay sober if I could do that, right? Well, we know that's not true. Chris is going to talk about this stuff. I mean, it's just, it's ridiculous. But there is the window missed. And because of the nature of alcoholism and the resurgence of this arrogance and this ego, we are in real danger. We think we're okay. Our head sells us the idea that we're okay, but we're really not. And that's the reason why there is indeed some urgency in getting started quickly in this stuff. One more thing, and then I'll sit down, and Chris could go ahead and start on this thing. In how it works in chapter 5, in the States, they read this before every meeting, nonstop. You get so tired of hearing it, sometimes you want to weep. We don't read it in our group because of that reason. But the we read some other stuff until you want to weep. But it's there was two qualifying deals. It said, if you have decided you want what we have, and are willing to go to any length to get it, period, or a hyphen there, then you're ready to take certain steps. They ask you two questions. So my little buckaroo here that was sick last night, that's still sick this morning, he's here, he just walked in. We're going to ask him two questions. Hey, Slick, have you decided you want what we have? Uh-huh. Okay, are you willing to go to any length to get it? Uh-huh. What's it say next, guys? Then you're ready to take certain steps. That's it. That was our only. That was where we were trying to get the guy in the first place. Once he's there and he's made that commitment, there's no sense waiting for him to sit there for 6 months to get comfortable. In the States, we hear this so much it drives me insane. Just well, we want him to be comfortable first. Why? Why? If he's comfortable, he won't do it. I want him sitting there in our first meeting. I want him sitting there wringing his hands. I want him in tears. I don't want him comfortable. Well, we need to let him get. Listen, Bill Wilson's in Towns Hospital. What is he, 3 days? And he begins doing the work. He's there, what, 7 days total? I forget. But Dr. Bob, within a week, he's done through the stuff. Dodson's the same way. All of these guys, man, they didn't waste any time. Go back and look at Clarence Snyder, who was one of the original early guys in AA. Look at his memoirs and look at how long it took most of these guys to do the work. I'll tell you this and then I'll sit down. In the last, maybe in the last 10 or 11 years anyway, I have sponsored hundreds and hundreds of men through the work. And I can tell you without any problem at all that in those instances, none of my men have taken more than 45 or 50 days to work through the work. That's a month and a half at the outside to work through that work. There was simply no reason to waste a bunch of time. And the idea that we have to take time is one of the opinions that we hear in AA that's founded on things that are opinions, because the literature tells us just the opposite. So stick with us. If it feels uncomfortable, welcome. It felt uncomfortable for me too. I fought it tooth and nail. I mean, really tooth and nail. No, we can't do this with these guys. It takes 6 months. It takes a year. No, it doesn't. And as you begin to get into this thing like that, so let me ask you this question. If you were sponsoring one man, you could effectively take a year to get him through the work and it wouldn't be such a big deal probably. But what happens if you're getting asked 10 times a week to sponsor somebody? What happens if you're trying to sponsor 30 men at a time? Now some of you are going, no, you can't do that. Yeah, you can. Yeah, you can. But you can't do it the old way. You can't do it the way you've been taught to do it. You'll have to look at it from a different perspective in order to do that. And once you do it, there's nothing cooler on God's green earth than to watch a sea of men in front of you recovering from this hopeless disease based on the steps that you laid in front of them. It's the most amazing thing you'll ever experience. It'll be a good morning, I promise you.
Go ahead, brother.
He's so rigid. My name is Chris Raymer. I'm a recovered alcoholic and drug addict. Thanks for coming back. Already been asked some great questions, and I know that we've got some folks here that weren't here last night, and so I want to just briefly kind of give you a 5-second disclaimer so y'all kind of know where we're coming from. We're here to share some thoughts based on our experience about working the steps and sponsorship. And you guys are free to agree or disagree. So one of the things I said last night that I think most of you took to heart, and I know some of you didn't because of your comments afterwards, you are so free to agree or disagree with anything we say. We're not here representing AA. We're not here trying to push into some kind of an agenda. Our experience comes from the perspective of what happened to us. I nearly died getting to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm 7 years in and out. I'm a relapsing fool. At the end of 7 years, tried to commit suicide because I couldn't get this. You follow? I'm going to meetings and they're telling me to keep coming back, and I'm doing that, but I can't stay sober. If y'all look in the first step, it says, you know, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives were unmanageable. You follow? And treatment centers, what we want to do is we want to use that unmanageability. We want to look at the outside stuff. That my life is unmanageable out there. That's not what the big book's saying. The big book is talking of unmanageability is internal. This is where the little buckaroo, the little issue man pins they're everywhere. Some of you guys have got them on. Don't even know what they are, but it means if you wear one of these, it means you're gay. And then it's like, no, it doesn't. I assure you. Issue man and issue, what we do is little lecture tools. It's like on the out. I don't have a little piece of paper here, but y'all can see the little. It's bigger. Can y'all see that? If you can't close one eye, you can see them better. These little X's on the outside are the outside issues. This is the unmanageability that everybody wants to talk about. This little dark spot in his little heart area is the unmanageability. That's the spiritual malady that the book talks about. And that's what we're going to talk about real quickly this morning. But it's this internal stuff that keeps me in trouble. You keep telling me to keep coming back, everything's going to be okay. And you want me to sit close. We have to love him until he can love himself. So I sit there and exactly what my brother just talked about, I do well for the first few days until this internal condition starts to come back. And then I start to implode. You know, I start to come apart at the seams. And then my head says it's time to go take a drink, and I go drink, and then you throw it back in my face that I just didn't want it. This is what took me to a suicide attempt in 1987. And finally in 87, somebody sat down and for the first time, they qualified me. They asked me some specific questions so I could get off the damn fence. We've got cats all over the world in Alcoholics Anonymous sitting on the fence. Y'all know what that means? Sitting on the fence. Maybe it's a Texas expression. It's like one minute, I know I'm an alcoholic. And the next minute, I think I'm a hard drinker. I think I'm having a little problem with myself. You got to get off the fence, one way or another. If you're not one of us, go away. That's one way. If you are, let's do the work, and then you can get in the trench and help us carry the message of hope and help others get well. And that's what we're going to be talking about today. So before I go on with this, I just want to make perfectly clear. You know, I got accused of taking AA's inventory last night. Now, I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I just... You know, the treatment centers, the way Myers just explained it, remove the urgency to do the work. I could talk for 2 hours on what happened to our fellowship. And I know some of you guys, you came in, you did the work, you got sober, you've never had a problem, and you're looking around like saying, what's the big deal? I'm so happy that you had that experience. But for many of us, we didn't have that experience. And I can't argue with your reality. And you can't argue with mine. I sat in Alcoholics Anonymous for 7 years without any direction. Now, whose fault was that? Ultimately, mine. I could have asked for some direction. I didn't know what to ask. Geez, we assume that the newcomer's going to know. You follow? That's how we've gotten in such trouble in our fellowships. I don't know what sponsorship is. I don't know where the big book is. I don't even know where the freaking bathroom is. And you want me to figure this out? I know you came and you got yours, and so you're happy and content. Well, why couldn't you get yours? Maybe I was in worse shape than you were. Maybe I landed in a group that didn't understand our primary purpose. Make sense? Alcoholics Anonymous in the United States is a self-help program. Did you hear me? It may not be here. In the United States, it's a self-help program. You come in, we're going to show you some ways to keep yourself away from alcohol. Is it any wonder that we don't all get confused? If you look at the big book's got some pretty rigid directions. These are some clear-cut, specific directions on how to have this thing called a spiritual experience. And then you turn around and somebody hands you a piece of crap literature, like it's called Living Sober, that AA produced in early 70s, 72. This Living Sober book. Now you take that and it'll tell you, listen, if you want to stay sober, just don't get too hungry, angry, lonely, or tired. Let me see. This says I need to work some steps and have a spiritual experience. This just over here says I just need to not get too hungry, angry, lonely, tired. Absolute crap. Is it any wonder that we confuse the you with us? This book says we have a spiritual experience, we get well. But you can pick up any copy of the Grapevine, and they'll produce an article just telling you just do this any way you want. So, you know, the problem is not that the steps are not worked correctly, because I don't think it's that critical. I think the steps are pretty open and roomy. The problem is that we're not working them at all. With the guys that I'm sponsoring, that's basically what I'm seeing. You follow? You do a 3-column fourth step, or a 4-column fourth step, or an 8-column expanded fourth step. I don't think it really makes a bit of difference. I think the longer you're sober, the more you can do different things. You know, the problem is not that you did a weird, goofy kind of fourth step. The problem is you didn't do a fourth step at all. And that's what we're seeing all over the world. People are talking about the steps, but they're not doing jack. And the reason? We're dragging it out too long. Make sense? If we mess around too long with this, my ego is going to rebuild itself. The internal condition is going to come back, and we're going to use again. So that's where we're at. The guys that in 1987, they qualified me that first night, and they spent it the next morning reviewing it and making sure that I understood. They'd watched me up in North Texas pick up chips for 7 years, and I couldn't stay. I wanted to stay sober. I needed to stay sober. And I could stay sober for short periods of time. I'm a 2-week wonder. Under the weakest excuse in the world, I can stay sober for 2 weeks. Y'all follow me? If she's particularly good looking, I've known to a month once before. But at the end of a month, she got ugly quick. And they're just like, oh, it's time for me to go. And we lose all of our reasoning. But these guys, they qualified me. What Myers was referring to is this, that the book talks about Joe and Charlie, you know, Joe and Charlie fame, they were big ones about bringing the bottom up. If you come in here questioning whether you're an alcoholic or an addict or not, that's good. And my job as a responsible member of AA is to qualify you and help you figure this out. If you come in here without a good case of alcoholism, I need to give you one. Make sense? It's not talk you into being one of us. It's to show you your truth based on your experience. Walks like a duck. Quacks like a duck. It's a duck. Why we freak people out is that we walk like ducks, we quack like ducks, and we think we're cats. And it really creeps our families out. They think they're kind of weirded out about this whole thing. So what we got to do with the newcomers, we got to help them figure this out. What happens is we want to get distracted. These guys will come to treatment in the treatment centers, and we tell them when they get there, it says, well, you know, you're an alcoholic and you're a drug addict and, you know, this is a disease. And we talk to them about the progressive nature and the genetic predisposition, and we get them kind of they start to kind of look, oh, I see, I'm not bad. I'm sick and I see this. And so we're going to tell them about the disease concept, and they get all excited. Then they go to therapy row over there where they sit and talk to the therapist, and the therapist say, okay, so now tell me why you drink. Well, because I'm an alcoholic? Oh, yes. Well, that's, yeah, but why do you really drink? You follow? This is what we do, and we just confuse the daylights out of the people that we're trying to help. I drink first and foremost because I'm an alcoholic, folks. I said it last night, and I know I scalded some of you, and I didn't intend to, but I'm going to say it again. If you're drinking because of something out there, and that's the only reason you're drinking, then let's do some good therapy around that out there. The exes, the external stuff. And then maybe you don't have to drink over it. What a concept, huh? That's what hard drinkers do. That's what drug abusers do. But the real alcoholic or the real drug addict will not be able to stop given sufficient reason. We can do all the therapy in the world. In the United States, we put alcoholics and addicts in jail. I don't know what they do here in Sweden, but they... Boy, there was a bunch of them on the street last night. Gee, they were howling. I was wide awake at 4 o'clock in the morning. They were howling outside our window. We were downtown. They were partying like a son of a gun. I was like, oh, buddy. This drop-dead good-looking blonde girl puking her guts out. I was like, buddy, that looks like so much fun. Out there freezing to death at 4, throwing up. Oh, my gosh. Those were the days. I spent 10 years in therapy trying to fix the problem. And every time I turned around, they were trying to help me with another issue. And at the end, they just throw up their hands and say, well, we really don't understand because we've worked on all this and you can't stay sober. And this is, I'm not knocking therapy because I think all of us need therapy. I think especially if you can afford it, good heavens, do it. I mean, it's a great way to unknot your life in a hurry. I can assure you of that. But all the therapy in the world is not going to fix this problem. This is a problem that the book says can only be treated spiritually. By that spiritual experience. And that's what we're trying to help you find. When I sat down, these guys finally qualified me. It was like a weight lifted off my shoulders. It's like, it's a death sentence, but at least now I know what's wrong with me. What took me to that suicide attempt was just frustration. Because I can see you quit. I'm sitting in a meeting and the idiot in the back said, you know, I got up this morning and I chose not to drink. Rock on. You know, I got up this morning and chose not to drink, and by 10 o'clock, I changed my mind. And I can't not, you know, my friend DJ says, at what point does I change my mind qualify for insanity? Because that's what we're doing. I mean, given good reason, I know it's ruining my life, but I can't remember the consequences like my brother just talked about. And so my head says it's time to go use. And what we're seeing now in the States, of course, is this mass exodus to the pills because that's okay because it's not drugs. That's medication. No, comma, it's not. It's drugs for most of us. But anyway, I sat down and these guys opened the big book. And for the first time, this is my story, folks, and I'm telling you, you can't argue with it. For the first time, somebody qualified me. I'm an AA for 7 years and nobody ever qualified me to find out if I was an alcoholic. This is a self-diagnosed. You're an alcoholic if you say you're an alcoholic. This is just not true. You're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous if you say you're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You'll follow? In order to be an alcoholic, you've got to have certain symptoms. And this is what we've got to help the newcomer find out. This is the most urgent thing that we need to do for the newcomer is to make sure that they understand they're one of us. If they have a thing called a first step experience, people, they want to argue. There's no such thing as a first step experience. Yes, it is. When this thing sinks into your psyche and you know that you're one of us and it finally dawns on you that you're suffering from a fatal illness, it's like being diagnosed with cancer. You will not feel comfortable in your skin. I watch them in treatment. Oh, guess what? I understand first step now. I understand first step now. No, you don't. Because you'd be in the bathroom puking if you understood the first step. Anyway, this is what it looks like. Alcoholics and drug addicts have three specific areas that they need to look at. There's a mental piece, a physical piece, and a spiritual piece. The physical piece is the easiest for most people to understand. Even Oprah understands this. Just the line is drawn right there. When alcoholics drink, there's a phenomenon called craving that kicks in. Dr. Silkworth truly understood this. He was one of the first medical doctors that started putting the pieces together. He could see similarities. I mean, look around this room, guys. What's a cross-section of humanity in here? We've got some beautiful people in this room. We have a couple of pretty damn homely people in here too, I need to tell you. We've got some rich people in here, poor people in here, black people, white people, gay people, straight people. The one thing that ties us together though is this disease. We all have the same symptoms. I can ask the 19-year-old to answer this question or the 90-year-old and the answer is going to be yes or no. You follow? It's going to be the same. That's why we got to stop separating our diseases out so much. It's you either got it or you don't. Physical. When I put alcohol in my body, can I control how much I put in there every time? or this phenomenon of craving kick in and make me drink more than I intended. Sometimes I can drink normally. I was a functioning alcoholic for years, folks. I had a social life in corporate America. Every time I drank, I didn't black out. Every time I drank, I didn't get drunk. Later in the illness, as it progressed, I did. Make sense? But the book doesn't ask me, did you ever black out? Did you ever rob a liquor store? Did you ever wreck a car? Didn't ask those questions. It says, did you lose control and drink more than you intended?
Yes.
Yeah, it's yes or no. You know, yeah. I give everybody one bonus puke. When you're a kid, you know, and you don't know what alcohol will do to you, you just drink until you explode. You know, and you're out in the front yard puking straight up. And then, you're sitting there thinking, I'm never going to do this again. And normal drinkers don't. You know, they go, I'm never going to do that again. They drink a couple of drinks. Oh, no, I'm starting to feel that way again. I'm going to stop. Not us. We do it again. So the question I guess we could just point down about the craving is, did you ever get sick more than once? Next topic. Okay. Let the record show that was a yes. Okay. But that doesn't make me an alcoholic. At that point, it's like being allergic to a food. You'll follow? It's like if you're allergic to iodine and shellfish, if you can't eat shellfish, you eat it, you get sick, says, geez, I can't eat shellfish, and you don't eat it anymore. At this point, it's the same. Oh my gosh, when I drink alcohol, sometimes I overdrink, stop drinking. That's where Nancy Reagan came in. Just say no. Did y'all hear she took a fall and busted her hip? Sorry. Just say no has killed more people than anything else I can think of, folks. I mean, what a waste of U.S. taxpayer dollars. If I could just say no, I mean, good heavens. I mean, how... Second piece. Up to the doctor's opinion, up to page 23 in our textbook, it talks about the physical. On the top of page 23, it talks about the crux of the problem being in our mind rather than our body. You'll follow? Detox gets us past the physical craving. Once I got this stuff out of my system, there's no more craving involved. There's obsession involved now. You follow? And that's what we have to... There's over 24 in the United States right now. There's over 24 anti-craving drugs coming down the pike. We have absolutely none for obsession, which is the pisser. Because that's the crux of the problem, is the obsession. And that's what the book is trying to say. Top of page 24... It talks about the mental obsession. The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Jesus, guys, you've either lost the power of choice in drink or you've not. This choice is so controversial. Well, once you alcoholics put it in your body, you've got no choice. But before you put it in your body, you do. I've heard it a million times. That's not true. That's a lie. And we've got therapists all over the world teaching that. We've got psychiatrists and doctors teaching that. We've got professors that don't understand. The symptom that kills alcoholics and addicts is this thing called the mental obsession. My mind says, when I've just come out of a DWI, I've been faced with a divorce, I'm not going to do this anymore. And I think I can manage the decision to stay stopped. And yet the book, clearly on page 24, in the next 20 pages, it explains, I don't have a choice whether I'm going to drink. I have thousands of choices, folks. Don't let me let you... We're not letting the alcoholic off the hook. People go swing back the other way on that one. Well, you're just letting them off the hook. If you're telling them they don't have a choice, they're just going to use carte blanche. No, we've got thousands of choices. I didn't know that. I got a choice this morning to get up and pray and meditate. I got a choice to come to conferences like this and expand my mind and learn, to work the steps, to turn around and help the newcomer. I make choices every day to stay connected spiritually. Guys, this is not a self-help program. I work the steps and get connected spiritually, and God removes the obsession to drink. Make sense? I could walk down on that street with Myers last night and get a little quick bite and watch people doing cocaine and watch people drinking and never once be bothered by it. Why? Because I have recovered. The 10-step promises have come true for me. I've been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. That's where I want everybody in the world to be. This idea that treatment centers teach is that if we can teach you to just watch for your triggers, everything will be okay.
Sorry, it just won't work. If you can choose not to drink, then do it. If your experience shows that you've chosen not to do it, but you do it anyway, you're in the right place. That's what kills alcoholics and addicts. Real quick, I'll let you go because Myers is going to pick up some rest of these. We're going to do some of this. We're going to show you how to get through these steps in a pretty good clip. When I sit down with a newcomer, I go over this stuff with him, the physical piece, the mental piece, and I'm going to clarify right then and there, do you understand this? Can you identify with this? 9 times out of 10, the results, the reaction you're going to get is, oh my gosh, it makes perfect sense now why I do this. And the first time, that's why one of us is alcoholics and addicts. We're so able to help other people like nobody else can because we've been there. One other piece that I hit on that I don't ever skip is that the spiritual malady piece. Because I got to tell you guys, nobody wants to talk about that. I guess because the word spiritual is involved and we got to talk about God. But the spiritual malady, the spiritual illness is as real as can be. If this is alcohol or drugs, which is the truth. I mean, the world out there, including most of the treatment centers that I've been associated with and have been around, believe that if I would just don't drink, everything will be okay. If you're a hard drinker, that's true. If you're a real alcoholic, that's not true. Make sense? If you're a hard drinker, detox is as hard as it's going to get. If you're a real alcoholic, it's just fixing to get tough. After detox, I can detox and start feeling pretty good. How many of us, we talked about it last night, we're feeling great, we're jumping around. Oh my gosh, who knew it was going to feel this good? And then the internal condition comes back. Let me describe the symptoms of the spiritual malady, the little dark part and the little issue man. The spiritual malady looks like this. How about irritable, restless, and discontent? Talks about in the doctor's opinion. Guys, when you're not drinking and drugging, forget the stuff in your system. You're goofy when you drink and drug. That's a given. When I'm not drinking and drugging, how about... have you noticed the times when you were irritable, restless, and discontent? Anxious. Bored. Depressed. Number one symptom of alcoholism and drug addiction is depression. And we medicate it with a pill every stupid day. The largest prescribed medication on the face of the earth today is antidepressants. Makes me want to puke. Not knocking them. The fact that it's the largest prescribed medication on earth makes me want to puke. Am I suffering from depression or am I suffering from untreated alcoholism? Page 52, the bedevilments. You trouble having trouble in personal relationships when you're not drinking. My first live used to go, I don't know what you did up there at that A&A place, but I like you better drunk. Yeah, me too, hon. Let's go. I understand that. Trouble making a living. What are you doing with the money when you get it? No sense of direction. Low self-esteem. Does this sound familiar? When I'm not drinking, guys, I don't do better. I do worse. The problem is not the drink. It's not the cocaine. It's not the pills. The problem is the untreated alcoholism that the alcohol and the pills treat. Does that make sense? Your families don't understand this, guys. They think if you just leave the dope alone, everything would be okay. Your external world will get okay. Those little X's will get okay. But this internal condition will start to come back. That's why we watch people 3, 4, 5, 6 months out who haven't worked the steps relapse. Why do they relapse? Because they're so damned uncomfortable in their skin, they can't stand it. They're driving down the road just irritable, restless, and discontent. And they're like grinding their teeth. And it's like, I hate my life. You could probably smoke a joint. Where did that voice come from? Pot. That's the ticket. Yeah. It's natural. It's legal in some spots. And before you know it, you've talked yourself into doing something really, really stupid. You put the pot in your body, the physical craving is triggered, the same area of the brain that lights up with the cocaine lights up. And before the night's over, you're looking for cocaine. You got a beer in your hand. How did this happen? How did it happen? Your mind told you it was okay. Why did your mind tell you it was okay? Because you're so damned uncomfortable you can't stand it. And you've been blocked from the sunlight of the Spirit. You'll follow? If you can't lay the booze down and get comfortable in your skin, you're not going to stay sober. And the newcomer needs to know this. Real quick. The guy says, what happens if you qualify this cat and he finds out he's not an alcoholic? Hot damn. What happens if you win the lottery and find Pamela Anderson on your front porch?
Yeah.
If we're not working on commission in Alcoholics Anonymous, folks. We're not. It's not that. If we find out that you're not, I've done you a hell of a service. Makes sense? Let's get you good, hooked up with a good therapy. Let's adjust your meds, pat you on the little popo, and go on about your business. I don't want you sitting in AA anyway, killing people with your crap. You'll follow? I want little knuckleheads that understand what we're talking about. That's the coolest. Myers is going to talk about second and third. I got kind of jumpy. I thought he was taking my coffee. Huh? This is, it's mine. This is only going to take about 10 or 15 minutes to do what I'm going to do here, and then we're going to go take a smoke break. And we spent more time on this step one stuff than anything else we're going to do today, because it's the most important stuff that you can do. These days, of the men that I sponsor, I am dismayed by how many men I sponsor that have been sober 15, 16, 20 years, 25 years, who still are ambivalent about their step one truth. They still don't really understand why they drink the way they drink. And I had a guy the other day said, well, what difference does it make? I'm here. I've been sober for 20 years. What difference does it make? It makes lots of difference. If I don't understand in here why I drink, if I don't understand it myself, I can't teach it. And if I can't teach it, I'm useless. I need to be able to explain to the new little buckaroo when he comes in why he acts the way he does. I need to be able to explain why his life is getting worse sober than better sober. I need to help him see this thing. And if I can't, there's where we end up in so much trouble. It's the reason why we see so many people with long-term sobriety relapsing in AA. It's hugely uncomfortable to watch these guys do this. These days, I used to sponsor nothing but indigents, guys right in off the street. For years, that was all I sponsored. Now, most of the guys I sponsor are old gray guys like me that are just full of themselves. And it's the weirdest. I love them to death. I just, because they'll stand there all stoic like this. They've been sober for a bunch of years like this. And they're just unraveling. They're just coming apart. Their families hate them. Their employers hate them. Everybody hates them. They're sitting in meeting and they're all angry and they're all just like, it's just horrible, horrible. And then, and above all, they have this little line of arrogance that runs in there that connects with only one thing. I've been sober X number of years. And because they've been sober for X number of years, they feel like they can't admit to the fact that they would never sit in a meeting and say, you know what, I've been sober 20 years and I think I'm going to die. I feel like I could kill all of you right now. You see? Which is what they'd like to say, but they can't say it because their group has made them an icon. They're something special sitting in their meeting. You see? And so the cool part about that deal is, guys, is that whether you're 1 month sober or 20 years sober, at any stage of the game, you can get back on the horse. At any stage of the game, you can come back in and gather the pieces back up again, shoot back through the work. 30 days later, you've had a new experience. I get so frustrated, guys, with these guys in AA and these gals in AA that want to maintain their AA stuff on an experience they had 20 years ago. It may have been warm and fuzzy 20 years ago, but it's living hell today sitting in my AA meeting. And that's why it shouldn't be that way. And it doesn't have to be that way. At any stage of the game, you can pull up and say, I'm done. I'm done hurting. I'm done being frustrated. I'm done being depressed. I'm done. We're not talking one bit here about booze or drugs. We're talking about an internal condition which is killing us. And we can address it any day. Let's say for the sake of example that this guy, where did my little sick guy go? He took his hat off and now I'm lost. Like, all right, my little sick guy came in. There you go. Thank you. All right. Now I got him pegged again. All right. So he comes in, and in a couple of minutes, we're sitting after the meeting. Chris was talking about this thing, the dreaded Q word, qualifying. You want to get some dander up in AA? Talk about qualifying a drunk. Well, you have no right to qualify. You have. Yes, I do. Yeah, I do. I can't label you an alcoholic. That's not my job. I can't call him an alcoholic. But I can help him intellectually connect the dots so that he can see what he is. And once he does that, there will be indeed this kind of weirdness going on there, because he's going to see that he has a disease that's chronic in nature. And because of the chronic nature of alcoholism, he's destined to die. He's destined to live a very painful life. And so I can do that. In our book on page 44, there, at the top of the page, this was the lead in to We Gnostics. They asked the question that Chris was just talking about. When you honestly want to, you remember that part right there? They ask two questions. Have you lost the power of choice and control? And so if I'm sitting in my first meeting with this guy, we're in a little back room off the meeting, it's after the meeting and everybody's all gone and cleaned up, and I'm just sitting with this guy, and in 30 minutes, we're going to do 1, 2, and 3. Most of the guys that I work with, this is exactly what we do. 1, 2, and 3, and he's ready to do his inventory in 30 minutes. It doesn't take a long time for him to get a grip on his alcoholism, because I'm going to help him see he either is or he isn't. If he says he is, we go on down the road. That's the reason why last night we were talking about all these nonstop discussion meetings where people are talking about, and identity meetings where people are just talking about war stories. What we teach the new guy is that the reason they drink is because they got a DWI, or because that their alcoholism is directly attached to the drama in their life, the divorce and the rest of it, which is crazy. It has nothing to do with that. They ask two questions. If when you honestly want to, they're talking about choice and control. If I tell my wife that I am never going to drink again, I promise, and then I find myself drunk again, I've lost the power of choice. It's that simple. If I tell my wife, I say, look, I'm going to get off work tonight and I'm going to go over with those guys and I'm going to have one beer. We're going to sit there and talk about the day, and then I'll be home, start dinner. I'm going to be there. And then I end up having 6 or 10. I've lost the power of control. That's it. That's the only thing we're trying to find out. And if you have there, the rest of this stuff is just talk. The rest of it is just drama. But it's not about who you are here. So once we know that, then we get, is this true in your life? He goes, Well, you know what? When I made that realization in my own life, I could only come up with one conclusion, that I'm an alcoholic. And then I just shut up. And he looks at me and he goes, click. That must mean I'm an alcoholic too. Well, it could be. It could be. You see what I'm saying? He's made up his mind. He's made the decision. I didn't make it for him. So he'd make the decision. And then we've got this choice about step two. The book says lack of power is our dilemma. If I had the power to make the decision not to ever pick up the drink again, would I be an alcoholic? No. I lack that power. That's where the insanity ties in. That's where all of this stuff gets so crazy. I do not have the power. A normal drinker does. What Chris was talking about. A normal drinker does. I lack that power. I cannot manage the decision to not take the first drink. That's the reason why your family thinks you're a fruitcake. Because they're normal and they can see. Well, it's like I got raped in a jail cell one night. It's kind of a weird deal, but in a drunk tank in Houston, Texas years ago. And it's an amazing thing. I get out. And I'm at home, and I've been out 12 hours. And I crack a beer, and I sit out on the couch, and my wife, the woman I was married to at the time, looked at me and said, What are you doing? And I just looked at her, and I said, I don't know, what do you mean? And she says, you get arrested because you're drunk, you had all of this crap happen to you in that jail cell, And what are you doing? And yet, I bet most of you guys in here have experienced the same kind of situation. Stone cold sober. And reflecting on everything that happened to us. The busted jobs, the relationships, all of the crap that happened. All of that stuff is evidence of what happens when I drink. I was not able to bring into my mind with sufficient force what happened. And I picked up that cold beer and I was off to the races again. That's insanity. That's insanity. And what I need, this spiritual part they talk about, this step two thing, is about coming to grips with the fact that there's something out there bigger than me that can fix this deal. It's not a big theological debate. You don't have to believe in my God. You don't have to believe in anybody. This isn't about this whole deal. I hear people talking about this. Well, I'm working on step two. And 6 weeks later, well, I'm working on step two. I'm just going... Okay. Do you believe in God? Uh-huh. Let's go to the next step, okay? It's it. We don't have to be going through the rest of this stuff. We don't. So, once we've made that decision, if I get a guy that says, I don't believe in God, then we'll talk a little bit. We might read We Agnostics, but we're going to talk about this. He's got a... Do you believe that there was something besides you that put those stars up there? Yeah, I do. Could you believe that that could also help you? Well, I don't know. Could you believe that whatever it is up there helped me? Well, it's obvious that you stopped drinking. I guess I could believe that. Terrific. Let's start there. We just have to make a beginning, guys. We don't have to have a full theological thing laid out in front of us. We just have to make the beginning, you see? And then we get to this third step deal where it talks about a decision was made. But of interest, if you look at it in your literature, did this make you guys... When I read this stuff... In our book, it's on 61, 62, and 63, right there before the third step prayer. But when you read it, did most of you guys wonder why they put it there and what it was all about? They start out with about the selfishness and self-centeredness, and I think it always seemed out of place to me, and it would be years before I would understand why Bill put it where he put it and why he put it there. But this deal... The book tells us that selfishness and self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our problem. Now, if they had asked me to write this, you know what I'd have told them? Booze and drugs. That's what I think is the root of my problems. And I bet most of you would too, wouldn't you? I mean, I want to make the connection there like that. My life is a crap hole. I hate it. And if I can get the booze and the drugs out of the picture, everything will be fine. That's the illusion that I sell myself. And that's why I'm so dismayed when it squeals off and I'm sober. When I'm 2 months sober and I'm so anxious and angry and frustrated with everything, I can't stand it. You see what I'm saying? That's the weird part. And so they're trying to draw this line there and get us to understand that maybe there's something else going on here. And in the big picture, it's this. I have a disease called alcoholism that's chronic in nature. But at the same time, I also have this thing about selfishness and self-centeredness that puts me in all kinds of bad situations. And as these situations get out of hand, the only thing that sounds good is what? A drink or dope. Life gets tough going. What's the first thing we reach for every time? You see? And that's the reason why Bill was trying to get us to isolate it and separate it and look at it and see that it was real. If I continue to live a life, selfishness and self-centeredness, if I continue to live a life run on this, I would never be able to be happy over here. Ever. Ever. And so they spend two pages, 60 and 61 and 62, three pages there, talking about... They paint a picture of what it's like to be selfish and self-centered. The greatest example I give, guys, you know, we'll look at it from a guy's perspective on this stuff. Pretend you're dating a girl. I would like to sell the idea that I am giving and loving to all women that I met. And the reality is not that. The truth is, once I look at it, is I'm a selfish, self-centered pig. And I'll do and say whatever it takes to get you to play. There is selfishness and self-centeredness at its ugliest, you see? And once I begin to realize that, once I begin to look at that deal, it's interesting. Look at, for a second, I'm going to read you something right in the third step prayer. In the center of this prayer, there's an interesting line. It says, "Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do thy will." Why did he write that way? Why is that prayer like that? Why didn't they write this, Relieve me of the bondage of alcoholism. Relieve me of the bondage of drug addiction. Relieve me. They didn't mention it. Why? It's a great question. And here it is. Because in the morning when I get up and I stretch and I open my eyes and I kind of look around, it is not alcoholism that's sitting there waiting for me. It's not drugs that's waiting for me. It's self and the bondage of self that's waiting for me. Left on my own devices, every thought that I have in the given day is about self. What I want, what I need, what I deserve, always. And it's there's another one that trips upstairs. That's good. That's great. I love her already. That you see what I'm saying? But if you until you begin to see in the big picture, that's the reason why Bill Wilson and those guys spent so much time writing it, so much time for us to understand that stuff, is because if we can get a grip on self, believe me, in a minute when we're talking about the inventory stuff, when we come back from this real quick break, we're going to be talking about primarily this debacle around self. Because that's what put me in the position. My head tells me that booze put me in a position for all the drama in my life to cut me to shreds. I drink because, I have this problem with my wife because I'm a drunk. The reality, I have problems with my wife because I'm a selfish pig. And because I insist that she does things that she doesn't want to do. I make sure that she sees things my way. It's important that she understands it. It's crazy. And when we look at this in all areas of our life, that's one of the great things that jumps out of an inventory. That's one of the things that we see that's just the most amazing thing in the world. Selfishness and self-centeredness is what's kicking your butt. You show me a guy that's a spiritual giant at one point in AA, and then you watch what happens on down the road when he has set this spiritual program aside and he's living life based on self. And he wants to look at all of the drama in his life. That's why we end up with so many people out there, guys, who are sober for X number of years, long-term sobriety, that can't have a decent relationship, that can't have a job that's worth a crap, that's always in conflict with everybody around them. You know, there was a guy in a meeting the other night that was 17 years sober. And he said, you know, I was at a gas station and some guy pulled up in front of me and I wanted to go kill that man. I understand the feeling, but I'm dismayed that a man that was in a spiritual program for 17 years would feel that way. I just wave at him, you see, because self is not important to me today. I know it is, but in other words, but if it gets grindy, if your guts get tore up when somebody does that, address self. Start looking at why it is that I get so grindy when that stuff happens. Why is it that that button, when it's pushed, throws me off into a tether? You see? And it's always about self. This is a good place to go smoke. And when we come back, Chris is going to shore up some loose ends on this stuff, and then we'll do step 4, and that'll be a big part of that. Thanks.